This is Peter Aldi, wildlife ecologist, teach biology at William Penn University, and this is the Prairie Farm Podcast.
I'm Doug Duren, a landowner trying to be a conservationist.
I'm Tabitha Panis, president of the Iowa Prairie Network.
I'm Ryan Callahan, director of conservation at Meat Eater.
Angela from Axe and Root Homestead.
Chris Helzer, the Nebraska director of science for the Nature Conservancy.
Judd McCullum from Working Class Bowhunter.
Taylor Keene, founder of Sacred Seed.
Ryan Bryson of Bryson Wildlife.
This is Luke Fritch.
This is James Holtz.
Joy Van Weingarten.
Sam Sobel.
Phil Ebert.
Julie Meachin.
And you are listening to the Prairie Farm.
The Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Welcome to the Prairie Farm Podcast.
What's the craziest thing that's happened with you and some students on one of your so-called field trips?
Wow. I guess one time I caught some students trying to hand feed a shark down in the Florida Everglades.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Had to put the nicks on that. But they were really happy about it.
Shark.
I think it might be on YouTube still somewhere.
Oh my goodness. Wait, so describe this. How were they like throwing?
So there was this guy that had come in from fishing and he had a bunch of fish to clean on the dock and his electric fillet knife wasn't working. And so the students, being good citizens, offered to volunteer to help him clean his fish. And as they were throwing fish guts and parts back into the water, some big sharks, I think they were nurse sharks, started coming around feeding on it. Oh, and of course, the 20-year-olds thought, hey, if I hold this piece of fish in the water with my hand, it'll take it right out of my hand. And my friend can film it on his phone, and that'll be great.
Oh, my man. Word. Yeah. So did you have to like get serious and yell at them or like,
hey. Well, not yell, but like, hey, boys, maybe not such a good idea. Let's keep our hands this true.
Hey, everybody, I want you to look around. This is a prime example of a frontal lobe not being fully developed. Oh man.
But they did have a good time and they talked about it all the way home. So.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. How many students do you normally take?
Anywhere from 10 to 15, as many as we can pack in a van with all our camping gear and stuff like that.
You were just in Louisiana?
Yeah, we were just down in Louisiana on the Gulf Coast.
Man.
Hanging out in the cypress swamps. And
where's your favorite place to go with the students?
Oh, wow. Probably the Bitterroot Wilderness, Selway Bitterroot in northern Idaho. That's Bob Marshall in Montana. That's a real
grizzly country, right?
Yeah, grizzlies.
Yeah,
you got to be a little bit careful where you put your food and what clothes you're cooking in. But
I wasn't too far from the Bitterroots back in June of 22, but I was in Montana.
Sure.
Just on that kind of, I don't know, it's probably less, I think it was 50 miles from Idaho maybe is where we were.
Yeah, it's beautiful country. I mean, it's such a mix of like Pacific Northwest, temperate rainforest, and then you got your northern Rockies. All that habitat just mixes together right there.
Yep. Any run-ins with a grizzly?
No, not with, well, I guess one time in Glacier, not a run-in, but pretty close.
Just a little tossle. He was wrestling around with it.
We had
shook hands, parted ways.
We had hiked up. I think it was a 9-mile hike up to the top of this mountain. We were going to look at the Grinnell Glacier.
Okay.
And it was one of those deals when I was kind of selling the trip to students. I'm like, hey, if you want to see some glaciers, this is one of your last chances. Yeah. They're not going to be here in 20 years. So see them now. And
really?
And so we were
in Montana, like
Glacier National Park. Yeah.
Really? So they're dwindling away?
Yeah, they're melting fast.
What?
Yeah, like they're wondering.
Nobody
like,
talks about.
Should we
this?
Change the name of this park in 50 years? Because we're not gonna have many glaciers left.
Yeah, I need to go.
Kind of, yeah, go now.
I've been there. I want to go again.
But we hiked up to the top, and you know it was middle of summer, August, and so it was hot. It was like 85, 90 degrees, and there's big icebergs floating in the water. And some of the students all have like research projects they have to do while they're doing this. Mm-hmm. And so one of them was looking at water quality from like the top of the mountain down the river to the bottom of the valley. And so they had brought their test kits and thermometers, and the water was 36 degrees. But when we got there, there was people swimming in it. Skinny dipping in it, actually. Kids want to do that. I said, well, maybe not. Keep your clothes on. And man, you talk about cold. I mean, it's just jump in, jump out, and your heart's beating. Yeah. And you can't feel your skin anymore.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
But hiking back down the mountain that evening, there was three grizzlies maybe 50 yards off the trail, just munching on berries, ignoring us, thankfully.
Oh, so was your heart beating?
A little bit. You know, it's kind of like, okay, kids, take a look. Snap a picture. Let's move along. You know, we don't want to stand here. And
it's so interesting to me when animals have that tolerance. Because I'm sure, I mean, you know well the strength of the nose of a grizzly is just unreal. It's one of the strongest.
2-3 miles they can smell something from.
So. Right.
That's crazy. One of the strongest. Wouldn't that be so overwhelming? Think of the thousands of things they're smelling from.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But they just decided like, nah, you know, I'm going to keep working on these berries here. And
yeah, for whatever reason, humans were not on the menu that day.
So. Right, right. Or even, you know, to where it's like they were just bothered by you being there. So they decided.
Right. And how much of that is just habituation where, you know, a grizzly way in the backcountry would not tolerate you that close. But since they're in a park
next
to a trail where they see humans probably every day, they're like, yeah, they're not bothering us.
We'll
wouldn't they be hungry for those humans? Because the humans look like they have, yeah, I don't know. Have the least amount of meat probably per pound of any.
I mean, they could certainly take us out and eat us if they wanted to. But for whatever reason, berries were more attractive that day.
Man, that's wild. I'm still caught on the, like, they can smell miles away. And they can, like, pinpoint what they want. I guess it's kind of like us seeing things. Like, I'm looking at you guys. I'm probably seeing hundreds of things in my eyes right now. And then I can pick and focus on which thing.
Sure, you're filtering out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. What's the right term for that? Anthropomorphizing or something like that?
Yeah, anthropomorphizing.
Anthropomorphizing.
Human qualities or emotions to animals.
Right, yeah. That's like, but that's all we can do when we consider the sensory experience of animals, you know. I like to hunt deer a lot, and they always talk about the only color deer can see clearly is blue.
Yeah.
And I guess we can do a comparative, you know, anatomy study of the structure of a human eye and the structure of a deer eye. But even still, like, it's kind of a theorized thing because, well, how do we know that their brain, I mean, we can study the brain too and the way that they're interpreting light, but maybe it's different.
You know? I think those were actually determined by food trial tests.
Okay. You know,
like a Skinner box, you know, where you push the button and food comes out.
Sure.
And I'm not sure the exact mechanism of it, but it was something where they were recognizing blue light and getting a reward.
Okay.
And other colors.
That's interesting. I've always wondered. I always thought it was just
Penrays, deer, you know, like a trial
thing. Yeah. Yeah, that's really
it makes me wonder all the times I've worn blue jeans shotgun deer hunting. Like, oh, maybe I should have another. My Carhartt's on or something.
Yeah, that's right.
See somebody with a blue rope tied to their tree stand.
Like, I know it. I know it.
Carefully making sure you're in the right direction so the wind won't pick you up and they'll smell you, but wearing blue jeans while doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, are those companies that really aren't like hunting based companies, but they try to market to hunters.
Sure.
And sometimes they commit that sin, you know, be like a blue sweatshirt with like camo trim on it or something. It's like, it doesn't work.
Someone here obviously doesn't do any hunting.
Yeah, I often wonder, like with my dog, you know, they're similar to what a deer can smell. And like, what smells bad to a dog?
Yeah.
You know? Because we have certain odors where like, oh my gosh, you know, rotting garbage, dead animals, that's bad. But a dog goes and rolls in that.
I know.
That's great.
Rolls in it and eats it, yeah.
So what smells bad to the dog?
Yeah, I call my dog a detritivore because he loves to, you know, eat and roll in death and poop.
Sure.
And so
gross. I wondered because I was watching this video of like, this is how a bee sees the world.
Yep.
And it was just a color filter on stuff. But they actually, like with their eyes so big, flies for sure, see like, have a wild way of seeing things. But I always wondered with like that Neuralink chick that they're putting in people's brains, if you could like put a setting on and all of a sudden see flies do. Yeah. And then
see an ultraviolet
have a seizure.
Like bees or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that would be, I don't know about cool. It would be intriguing.
Yeah, you'd see prairie flowers in a whole new way.
Yeah.
See all the patterns.
Delicious. Yeah. They'd be like, I need to eat that thing.
Yeah. That's right. We got to get one more good story out of you before we like get rolling here on the on the meat and potatoes. But you told us about another field trip where you were around saltwater crocs with the students.
Yeah. That was down in the Florida Keys. We'd been to the Everglades and we were down in the Keys. And this is actually at the Everglades. It's near the ocean and you get saltwater American crocodiles down there. And they're, I think, probably the biggest reptiles in the continent. You know, they can get upwards of 20 feet, real big one. And
there bigger reptiles?
I think that's probably the biggest.
Okay, because the only other thing.
Komodo dragons are like 10 feet.
Komodo dragons are the creepiest, scariest creature on this planet to me.
Why?
Like, they're just like, I mean, imagine something that can outrun you on land. It's just, it would knock you down off your feet, you know, give you like a tail whip or body check you or something. Yeah. And then they got these razor sharp backwards facing teeth. So they just like slowly just like engulf you.
And toxins in their saliva.
Yeah.
I heard that a big part of their kill for really huge animals like buffalo, water buffalo, is to just bite and hold on and for hours and let the infection set in. And then like, yeah.
Are they the ones that have the super like, they have tons of bacteria in their body, or is that the Gila monster?
No, that's the Komodo. Although I think I read something recently where they said that's probably not it. They think they're actually some kind of like toxic, like a venom.
Okay.
Because they're saying, well, yeah, it makes sense. You know, they're eating all these dead goats and whatever, and they probably have a lot of bacteria. But how long would it take for septicemia to set in? Mm. You know, for that animal to get blood infection and then die, that could be days.
Mm-hmm. Animal Planet lied to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I heard that too, and like I said, it's fairly recent research, and I'm not sure how well developed it is, but they're saying at least somebody's thinking that no, there's probably toxins, and I think they've done some tests to find that there's some kind of venom in there.
That's fascinating. But anyway, so crocodiles down the Florida
keys. So the students saw that there was canoes to rent, and with wanted to do that. I said, okay, I will do that for the day. Sounds fun. So we rented a few canoes, and you know, you're right on the ocean, but then you can go up the river back into the lagoons and stuff. And the crocodiles are right there by the coast because they tolerate salt water, and the alligators are more up in the fresh water. But we're paddling along, and there's crocodiles like literally right next to the canoe. And I'm like, hey guys, keep your hands and your feet in the boat kind of thing. I'm thinking, this is a little nuts. Like, but hey, they rented this canoes, it must be fine, right? And then later that night, I was talking to one of the park rangers there in the national park, and I said, yeah, that was kind of crazy letting us, you know, go out in canoes with crocodiles right there. And he's like, oh, I can't believe they let those concession people rent canoes. This is breeding season for those crocs. They're super aggressive this time of year. And then I'm thinking, whoa.
Anything to that, make $18.
Yeah. You know, glad that went okay.
Man, that's terrifying.
But we did have a good time, paddled through all these mangrove swamps.
Came out with a great story.
Yeah. Saw a lot of alligators, too.
Any bull sharks? Did you see any bull sharks?
Not there, no. We saw nurse sharks, like I was telling you guys, where the students were trying to hand-feed the sharks coming up for the fish bait. But
What's one last place, like if there's a place that you don't get to before you're called to the Great Yonder?
Oh, man, like bucket list kind of stuff. Boy, New Zealand would be fun. I've had some former students that are working down there now, and I see pictures on Instagram and hear stories, and so yeah, that would be a neat place to go.
Man, well, sounds like you got your next field trip planned.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
All the way to New Zealand. I had some friends that planned they were about to be foster parents, so before they did like a baby moon, but for foster kids, and they planned a trip to New Zealand, and I can't remember what happened, but it was supposed to be like 2 weeks. I saw them at church a few weeks later. Hey, how was your trip to New Zealand? Well, it was end up being a staycation. I guess there were some issues in New Zealand where they couldn't get over there, and they had a hard time canceling like their flights and stuff like that. But I guess the hiking's just unreal.
Yeah,
in New Zealand is what I've been told.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can hunt a lot of things, too. Because I think pretty much every mammal is introduced.
Yeah.
And they've got a bunch of crazy things, like Himalayan tar and, you know, those red stags from Scotland.
And the Roosevelt elk.
Yeah.
That's one of the places on the planet.
So they didn't have any of their own mammals?
No.
Because Australia does.
It was all birds and reptiles. It was just isolated. So, you know,
is it the same with, like, Hawaii?
Yeah, Hawaii, I don't think they had any native
I'm trying mammals. To think what, well, bats would be on native to Hawaii.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's about it, I think.
Yeah, that's
wow. Good.
Yeah, bats. All your pigs and rats and
axis,
all that stuff. Yeah, that's been brought over goats. Since. Yeah.
A lot of stuff like that. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting how thoroughly changed so much of the planet is, you know. Even
we've moved stuff all over the place.
Yep, and it's been going on for a very long time, too.
Yeah, I often think of that, like right now in Iowa, here we are in April, and everything's green, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you were 200-300 years ago in Iowa, there would not be much green right now.
Yeah.
This prairie has not really started to grow up.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, unless it had been burned or something, you might have a little bit of green coming in, but old last year's growth would be all brown and gold right now.
You know what I don't understand?
Cool season grasses.
Yeah, like Virginia Wild Dry and Canada Wild Dry. So if you plant those in a very well balanced prairie field with let's say 80 species, it will fizzle out. So like, how was Virginia Wild Dry and Canada Wild Dry and Hairy Wild Dry or Silky Wild Dry? I guess some people. How are those staying alive?
You're getting to one of my questions, and I'm gonna ask it because it's a hypothesis I have, and Nicholas told me that you have done some grad work or some extensive research into animal hide transfer of seeds.
Yeah, so my PhD research at Iowa State
was
looking at bison and seed dispersal in tallgrass prairies.
So you are the guy to talk to then.
And
so,
yeah, some of those species, like maybe the rye, maybe milkweed, maybe partridge pea, maybe that thrives on disturbance by big animals like bison, where they're creating some bare ground that those guys can get a foothold and, you know, not be
okay. Yeah, so that's part of it for sure, where they're creating that bare ground. I didn't even think of that.
Like wallowing that, and things like that.
I mean, I've definitely thought of the wallowing as being like, maybe that's a way that they're getting seeds that are stuck in their hide back in the dirt.
For sure.
But going off of what Nicholas said there, some of these species that, and it'd be interesting to know, and burning is an evolving understanding, and the word's gotten out fast, right? I think probably podcasts are part of that, but also audiobooks and things like that. People are able to access that information faster than ever.
Yeah.
But it used to always be, when I was a kid, I remember doing a prairie unit in grade school, in second grade. And I think we went up to the Nechusa grasslands prairie, because I was in northern Illinois when I was a student. And, we learned, there'd be lightning strikes somewhere, and then the prairie would catch on fire. And I just remember thinking even then, it's like, man, how often does that actually happen? Because I've seen a lot of lightning strikes in my life and zero lightning caused fires, you know what I mean? But so maybe yes, that was part of what we found, is that was part of like what Native Americans did. They burned the prairie regularly. And some species, and maybe they had it down to a science themselves, to where they knew that they had to burn at different times of the year.
Sure.
But we know that if you just burn in the spring year after year, I think this is what Nicholas was getting at, like, you're going to lose your Virginia wild rye. You're going to lose your prairie June grass. You're going to lose your side oats grama, because they start to, like, that's when they're coming back from dormancy.
Yeah. I've read a lot of historical accounts and talked to folks that have researched this, and it seems like most of the historical fires were set in the fall.
Okay.
Like November seems to be.
That's really interesting.
You know, in fact, I was just reading it. A guy at church loaned me a book. It was a history of Lucas County. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had these pioneer diary kind of things, excerpts in there. And they talked about, you know, when the first European settlers moved in there, it was fall was the time you had to watch out for prairie fires.
Really?
Yeah. And I've seen that a lot of other places too, where spring burns.
That's really interesting.
We think about that, like in the Flint Hills of Kansas. That's a common land management, when they put stocker cattle, steers out there to graze all summer, and they'll burn it in spring. And they've been burning like every spring for 100 years, 150 years. But it's become very grass dominated, which is fine if you're raising cattle. That's what you want.
Right. Yeah. Because a lot of forbs, they are greening up this time of year. Carol and I were just out checking fields last week, and one that really shocked me was Rattlesnake Master. That was really far along already.
Yeah.
And that doesn't bloom until when, like July, August, Nicholas? And it's definitely one of the later harvests.
Yep. Right now in our yard, we have basically an oak savanna in our yard, a remnant, and we've got prairie larkspur and spiderwort that's greening, summer blooming. And if we had a fire run through there now, that would all be toast.
Yeah, yeah. So it gave me the question that Nicholas asked you, that I've been wondering for a long time, was the fall fire, that helps answer part of it, of course. But then even still, like, Nicholas, correct me if I'm wrong here, but from what you've seen on old CRP plantings, even if they aren't being burned at all, Virginia, Canada, and mainly those two fizzle out in the stand. And part of that is just like the other grasses are more dominant. But is that related to they don't have that great those other more aggressive grasses don't have the grazing pressures from the bison and elk.
Yeah.
But then also they don't have the reseeding method coming from the animal hides.
Yeah, totally could be. I mean, I think there's so much we don't understand. I remember reading papers in grad school about
squeaky chair, everyone.
Oh, you're good. Various, prairie reconstructions where, these were done a long time ago, and they're talking 20 years out, 30 years out. We're starting to see species drop out of this mix. Like species we planted did great for a few years, and now they're gone. So how would those, like you're saying, stay in a natural prairie? And part of that might be we just don't have the disturbances or these, ecological functions that were present when you had millions of acres of prairie. When you're trying to manage a couple hundred acres or something, maybe you don't have that pollinator that needed to be in there. Maybe you don't have that bison or the elk or things like that that was doing something that maybe we don't understand it totally right now, but something was going on that isn't there. And so, the disturbance by bison, they stay on pretty well-worn paths. So you'd have bare ground there and they wallow. Mm-hmm. And then, the seed dispersal, moving things around. That's one of the things that I found with my research is that, typically when we talk about long distance dispersal, that's a rare event, like a huge windstorm, a hurricane kind of thing. And it gets a seed away from the parent plant more than 100 meters. That's kind of the threshold. They say, okay, if it's more than that, this is a rare long distance dispersal. You're spreading plant genetics, you're colonizing new habitats, that kind of stuff. Bison pick up a seed and they go 100 meters like right now. Hmm. That's now. And then they might go miles that day. They might go hundreds of miles in a year. So that's moving plant genetics and getting things to new places that, you just don't see now when we don't have bison on most prairies.
How big of an impact do you think it had on the North American prairie landscape?
I'm guessing a lot. We don't have a way to quantify it right now, but...
It's like online dating. Instead of just dating in your hometown, you can now date wherever you want, get genetics all over the place.
Yeah, I would think the answer to that lies in some kind of genetic research. Looking at genetics of plants and then maybe being able to find, old herbarium specimens from 100 years ago and looking at those genetics for 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And then, trying to see, are we getting inbred plants because they're not being moved around or that kind of thing.
Ooh, you just touched on something that Nick always wonders about.
Yeah.
With, I'll let you, since I had to recapture my question, you, take this one, Nicholas. It's your question about
Freud's
pulling from the same remnants and stuff.
Yeah.
Or same ecotype or region. Yeah.
Yeah. So you and I, the Tallgrass Prairie Center, right? They do, an Iowa ecotype project.
Yeah.
And
I worked on that when I was an undergrad.
Really?
Yeah. I collected seed for that.
Who is there then? Who was the guy in charge? It was before Laura.
Oh, man.
Who was there before
Laura? I could come up with his name. Any other?
Kirk? He was the IRVM guy. Henderson.
I don't know.
Paul Bach, instead, was the grad student who was on it when I was working there. And Laura Jackson had just started. She was like
It was the guy who was in Laura's position right before Laura.
Okay.
Went
into I'm not sure who he was. He was before me.
Anyway, but so, they collect seed, and if they can't, sometimes they just have, it's such a rare thing, they collect it from three places and call it an Iowa ecotype, and sometimes they'll say, ecotype project one, or zone two, or zone three, and so they can split it up that way. But, and people are really particular about their ecotype because of genes, but I guess I don't understand why we can't pull from a much bigger area. I'm not saying Mexico. Let's say purple or pale purple coneflower. I'm not saying go to the southern tip of Texas and southern Canada and pull all the way and get in between. But why can't we go southern Missouri to central Minnesota or northern Minnesota, bring them to central Iowa and call it good?
Yeah.
Why can't we get all those genetics?
Yeah. I've heard arguments both ways. Some are we got to have the 20 mile radius or 50 mile radius. And others are 300 mile radius. Mm-hmm. So I think it depends on who you're talking to and, what the flavor of prairie restoration is that week.
Purists.
Yeah. Cause I mean, I get the local ecotype, local weather conditions, local soil conditions, all that. But like you're saying, are you inbreeding plants, planting this everywhere. Do we need to mix up genetics? Would they have been mixed up by things like bison and, you know, birds and who knows, moving seeds around farther distances?
I feel like, well, and then even with us producers, we have to think about, like, how many generations are we going to take off of? So most of our seed we either hand collect very nearby off a remnant or different remnants, or we get it from Tallgrass Prairie Center. Then we plant a plot. Well, in 5 years, that plot's not good anymore. So we have to plant another one. Okay, so now Tallgrass Prairie Center had some. By then, it's already generation two. We plant a generation three. By second or third round, we're generation four, five of breeding with the same, you know, and at what point are you like, yeah, this isn't going to work. We need to
Mix it up a little bit. Yeah, if you're a livestock producer, you'd be thinking, I need some new blood in there.
Yeah. So what we need to do is just go get some more, whatchamacallit, like go to a remnant, get some more pale purple coneflower.
Sure.
Throw it in the field. But it is difficult because, for instance, Canna Wild Rye. Iowa ecotype Canna Wild Rye does not get you very much Canna Wild Rye per acre when you're producing it. But Mandan Canna Wild Rye, which I don't know where that's from.
My guess is, isn't that South Dakota or North Dakota where the Mandan?
Yeah, that's where they would have come from. So if they named it after that, yeah.
That, I mean, that's my guess. But that Canada Wild Rye will produce like three times as much Canada Wild Rye poundage per acre. So you can charge a lot less. So what farmer in their right, quote unquote, financial mind is going to say, yeah, I really need that Iowa ecotype stuff. I'd love to pay three or four times as much, you know. Most of the time, they're like, nope, just make sure it meets those requirements. And so how big of a deal is it to bring that Mandan? Is it going to pollute our Iowa ecotype fields that are nearby? I don't know.
Yeah, makes you wonder. That's a big question.
Man.
I think a lot of people have been asking that for years. We don't really have an answer. Yeah. In theory, you know, don't get something from halfway across the continent.
Right.
But,
makes you wonder. It brings up a whole nother can of worms, too, with how we view – you know, restoration or reconstruction biology, right? And you know, we've talked to a guy recently, great person in the prairie world, Pete Berthelsen, and he's like, I understand all that side of it, and yes, in a perfect setting, I'm all for it, but more so, I'm just all for getting whatever I can, wherever I can get it. And he's not talking about purchasing seed. He's like, what, you know, who holds control of this land? And what is their tolerance for prairie? And I want to go as far as their tolerance will allow me to go with restoring prairie there. And if that means that's going to be big blue stem Indian grass and little blue stem, that's all they want. Well, so be it. That's better than Reed Canary, Kentucky Blue, and Smooth Brome, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
And so, you know, I think the answer is probably somewhere in the middle, like pretty much everything else in the world. But I also think it's important that places that are strict about this exist, because humans water down everything, right?
True.
If we don't have someone who, you know, it's kind of like some of the really prestigious organizations or events, like, for instance, I'm thinking of the Masters, right, for golf.
Yeah.
There is a set number of tickets, and there is no like ifs, ands, or buts for getting into the Masters. In fact, it's like a big deal that if you know somebody, I know this because my brother used to live in Augusta, Georgia, and he got to go to the Masters 1 year. And it's a big deal when you know somebody who's going, like, hey, can you buy me a hat while you're there? Can you buy me a polo? Because that's the only way you're getting one. You know, like, you got to be there at this golf tournament to get it, right? And it would make it so much, and maybe there is some other like market outside of there, you can go on Amazon maybe and just buy one or something, but to like get like the official thing or a golf ball or something like that, like, you got to go there or know somebody who did. And it's kind of cool that they do that, you know, and because it does, you know, protect the aura of what it is, the Masters, right? And so it's important that we have people who are strict about the ecotype and, you know, tracing back a genetic line and trying to match that genetic line with that region that it's from. Because if we were allowed to just get sloppy with bringing in, you know, seed from wherever and putting it into, you know, mixing it with reconstruction projects near a remnant or something like that, I think we would lose a lot of these things, you know, completely.
Yeah, it's always nice to have that, you know, museum piece or that standard to measure other things by, for sure.
Right, right. And so, you know, it might seem kind of like those people are the rain on the parade kind of people, you know, like they're too stuffy over it or too stodgy or whatever the word is. But I think it's they play a really important role and a difficult role.
Sure. You know, I mean, you get so many varying degrees of prairie purists. You know, I know people that will not burn because insects, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's other people like, I'm going to torch everything every year.
Well, that's what I was thinking about when you said that the indigenous people were burning in the fall. Think of how hard that was on habitat for wildlife.
Right, winter habitat.
Going into the hardest time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure there were areas that didn't get burned.
Yeah, but you could burn 5 million acres of Iowa, and there would still be 16 million more acres of habitat than there are today.
Right. Yeah, the scale is much different than today.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I heard this in grad school once where I think it was a class we were taking where they were talking about that sort of idea of like, was it native tribes doing most of the burning? Was it lightning strikes? And they were saying, well, you know, think about a lightning strike. Like you're saying, it's rare, happens every once in a while, but there's nothing to stop that fire.
Yeah,
no roads, true. No farm buildings. You know, it just goes and goes and goes. Yeah. And so it probably burned a much bigger area when it did happen.
Yeah, and I learned recently, several years ago now, I guess, I was because it was when I was living in Davenport still. It's been a while.
Just the other day.
Yeah. That's how you know you're getting old when you say, I heard a lady yesterday, again, on the Meteor podcast. She's like, yeah, I bought a boat a few years ago. I think it was back in 2018. It's like, that's more than a few years ago.
Yeah.
But
my mother-in-law says the other day, and that could mean any time in her life.
That could mean anywhere from the Nixon administration to present day.
I mean, for real, she'll say stuff like when she was a teenager. She'll be like, oh, yeah, the other day I was. I'm like, well, this means, I mean, technically, yeah, you're right.
Hey, but, be careful. You're talking about your mother-in-law.
No, she's great. You got to meet her. She's like a very fun human being to be around, but man, she loosely uses that term
I'm guilty of that. Somebody will say, you're gonna get a new whatever. I'm like, well, I just bought this. Well, I guess that was 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, or like 2014 still feels like a fresh my goodness year, and we're 10 years away from that.
I know that was the first year I started teaching, and now I'm into another career going on year 3 here pretty quick. But the thing I heard was, and this was on Meteor, they were talking about how a wildfire started because like a month previous, an old dead tree got struck by lightning, and it didn't like just, you know, turn into an inferno. It just kind of like, you know, like smoldered.
Yeah.
And it smoldered down in the roots, the dead roots of the tree. So like mostly underground, obviously it's still getting oxygen there to feed that ember that was glowing, but eventually, you know, wind picked up or something, and it all of a sudden now it's an open flame, and now the whole valley's on fire.
Sure.
You know, and so I think that probably happens too with, or happened with those big prairie burns, was, you know, there weren't many trees, but an old dead one got struck, and
yeah,
it just smoldered, and then the conditions are right, took off, you know. So
yeah,
I don't understand fire. I was thinking about this. I know this is like a tangent, but look, if you put fire in water, it goes out, right? Is that because it immediately is cooled, so there's not enough energy to create the fire, or is it because there's no oxygen? Or if it's both, if you put something really cold in a fire, it doesn't go out, it heats up. So yeah. I don't understand.
Yeah, that's a good
I think it must be a combination. I mean, I'm not a physicist, but I think lack of oxygen and lack of heat.
Yeah.
Remember that old fire triangle? You're taking away two of the legs there.
Yeah, that's right.
Collapses. Yeah. Okay, I actually don't remember the old fire triangle.
Oh.
But what I need to do is look it up, or someone...
So, yeah, oxygen, heat, and fuel are the three legs of the fire triangle. You have to have all those for combustion.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's a chemical reaction that's happening.
I get that part.
And a lot of people think of fire as like something you can put on the shelf, you know, like I'm going to pick up that fire, you know, like it's a physical thing, but really it's just like when you're looking at a flame, it's not really, I mean, it is, but it's like, it's a symptom of there being heat there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
well,
it's
but a, I mean, so that's true, but, like metal, why does metal have to get way hotter than wood to have any fire?
Yeah, because of the molecular structure of it.
So there's no fuel.
There's no fuel. It just takes a higher combustion rate to light metal on fire versus wood.
All burning is oxidizing. And
at a very fast rate or something?
Well, and depending on what's being oxidized, it's going to give off a different characteristic of that reaction. And so you're having an exothermic reaction that's producing a flame maybe, or it's producing a glow, or it's producing smoke, you know. There, it's like a symptom of that reaction that's happening.
I have a lot more questions, but we're not here to talk about me not remembering anything from sixth grade. So someone please email me and explain this to me.
I want to ask some more hide and animal hide and prairie questions.
Yeah, right? Sure.
So I imagine you've probably read this book, if not, definitely read it. A Country So Full of Game.
Oh, yeah. Jim Densmore's. Yeah, yep. It's a good one.
Yeah. And in that book, he talks about how, I tried to get him on the podcast, by the way, and he was nice. He emailed me back. He declined, but.
Well, he and his son, Steve, they just wrote like an update to that one.
Oh,
just
really?
Came out a year ago. It's like, you know. The last 30 years.
Birthday's
of
coming, Nicholas. Got my work anniversary's just like a month and a half away, buddy.
I got it in the bookstore here in town.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I might be stopping there on the... I'm definitely stopping there. Is it...
Yeah, the bookstore. I'll put a plug in for those guys.
Okay.
Great little...
This is the one that bookstore. You... Like over by...
It's right on the square. Right next to Smoky Row.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
Oh, not really
on the campus. Okay, okay.
Yeah, it connects between Smoky Row and the bookstore.
There's really?
Okay. Hey, don't be plugging Smoky Row. We're plugging my coffee shop.
Go to plug it in. Nicholas's coffee shop in Knoxville.
Inspired Drinko.
But in there, he talked about, maybe he's updated this, that Iowa would have most likely had way more elk than bison.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot.
And
bison would have mostly been up in the northwest corner of Iowa. That's where the big herds were. But, you know, there's reports.
But they were throughout, right? Yeah, they were, I mean, just not in great number.
Yeah, not like the short grass prairie or the mixed grass prairie. For some reason, tall grass prairie didn't have as numerous a bison.
And they, it's not a nutrients thing or in the...
No.
Maybe they just like the warmer air. I imagine they have a hard time staying warm.
Where they like...
They're actually the best at staying warm.
They like shorter vegetation.
Shorter vegetation.
Okay. Could be it. I mean, I know at least from people that raise bison in Iowa, they have trouble with pink eye because of the tall grass rubbing on their eyes. So maybe you don't have that in shorter vegetation out west.
That's true. Whenever you look at a buffalo eye, that thing just looks nasty. You know what I mean? It just looks injured.
Oh, man.
And there's been talk of, you know, maybe bison moving into Iowa in the spring, you know, after things have burned and it's just greening up, and then crossing the Missouri River, going back into Nebraska and the Dakotas for the summer, you know, those little seasonal migrations going on.
Yeah. So relating to your research then, was seed dispersal by elk hide and by, it's easy to picture in a buffalo hide, right? They got the big mane on there. That's just so tangly and like,
it's perfect. Like sheep wool. Yeah. It catches everything.
Right, yeah. Imagine walking through like some beggar's lice with that on, some Illinois tick trefoil. It'd just be, like, you'd be stuck forever. But
yeah, imagine like just having a rug on your back. Yeah. While you're trying to,
But the it's easy to see how they would have dispersed seeds a lot. But elk hide, they kind of got a mane too.
Yeah, it's not as much.
Right. So and especially deer hide is very slick.
Yeah.
And I've pulled, you know, almost every deer that I've harvested through the years. I can pull little beggar's lice out of the...
They've got stick tights and things like that.
Right, but did they play a major role in seed dispersal for
elk,
the prairie
deer,
species?
Probably not as much. I mean, certainly some.
Okay.
We actually had a little side project, an undergrad that I was working with. She was one of our field techs. She was interested in that very question, like what seeds are elk picking up? Deer, fox, badgers, all the other things are out there.
Oh, interesting.
And so we rigged up, it was kind of a crazy experiment. We had a little UTV that we had to drive around. It was one of the regulations for being on that, because I did most of my research at Neil Smith National Wildlife
Refuge. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like yep. Federal place. And they didn't want you walking around with the bison for safety things. And so, I mean, we obviously had to walk around to do stuff.
Yeah.
But we'd drive
how about place a to horse? Place.
And so we basically made this quilt out of all different kinds of animal hides that would be found in the prairie.
Oh, that's cool.
And we laid it over the front. And as we were driving around through the prairie, it would pick up seeds and then we'd comb them all out and then count them and identify all the seeds and see like how much get picked up by bison, how much get picked up by elk and fox.
Oh, that's
and
interesting.
And, you know, surprisingly, well, I guess not surprising, but bison with their big, thick hair was like 10 times or more seeds than everything
wow.
else. Yeah. So red fox with that long, soft hair, mm-hmm. it was like number two, but it was way down the list from bison, you know, as far as numbers of seeds and
yeah.
types of seeds.
That's yeah. Let's hear some more data on this. We should have asked you to bring like your data sheet with you.
But, oh, no, but, that's good.
But like what's – so I imagine bison pretty much they picked up anything.
And yeah, everything. Anything and everything, really. You know, you expect those Velcro kind of mm-hmm. seeds, cockleburs and stuff.
Side oats, grama.
Yeah, I mean, those stick to me when I'm walking out yeah. through the prairie. But, yeah, even like smooth, hard, round seeds would stick in the bison hair.
Really? Yeah. Like bush clover and
purple prairie clover.
Yeah, and exactly. Flower, yeah. And then all your asters and goldenrods with their little parachutes, yeah. they'd blow into the bison and get caught up in the hair and stick
that's
into
so
them.
So interesting. It's like, it's an example of being perfectly fit to that ecosystem yeah. and filling a massive niche.
And so when ecosystem. Most of your native plants are putting out seed in the fall, you know, that's when the big load hits, you know, all your native species are getting caught up in the hair. And then as they're walking around through the winter, certain percentage of that falls off. So basically bison have been frost seeding prairies for thousands of years,
that's
you know,
so
which
cool.
today, I mean, you ask any manager like yeah, that's the perfect way to plant.
Yeah.
You know, is go
yeah.
throw frost it on the seeding, snow.
So January, February or.
Yeah. In the winter, you know, throw it down right on the snow or right before snowfall mm-hmm. hits.
Yeah.
And, you know, that freeze thaw cycle over the winter works the seed just into the surface of the soil. So it's perfect planting conditions.
Right.
And bison have been taking seeds and moving those long distances and yeah. then giving it the perfect conditions to be planted.
Yeah.
And then like you're saying, you know, when they're wallowing, you know, they roll back and forth on the ground, not in the winter, but in mm-hmm. the warm months, like a dust bath kind of, it's not an elk wallow where it's muddy. It's like a dust bath.
Right.
They'll roll back and forth on the ground 3 or 4 times and get up and shake themselves off. And, they're knocking seeds off that are stuck in their hide. And then, you know, from like right now in spring all the way up through middle of summer, they're shedding their winter mm-hmm. coat. And so yeah. big clumps of hair are falling off and they're getting stuck in the earth,
yeah.
that bare dirt of the wallow. And it's basically like they've tilled a garden and now they're planting it.
Yeah.
And so.
Is yeah. that hair good for the seed?
You know, like you know what that makes, you know what that makes me think of, Nicholas, that hair is, the harrow on the back of our hoxie cedars, how Carol talks about how it fluffs up the like whatever oh, yeah. is on the, you know, the dead matter on the surface to kind of like helps hold in moisture, you know, when you get a good rain and protects it from birds and, you know, just basically helps the seeding, you know, it gives yep. it a level up. That's what that bison hurt.
Yeah. So when that like. Gets packed into the ground, it's like kind of half buried. I mean, that's holding moisture. It's actually kind of protecting the seed from seeing predators, you know,
yep.
from small mammals, birds, ants that might want to grab that seed and eat it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of protecting that some. So yeah. we actually did a whole other side project on that.
Yeah.
Another undergrad field tech was working on that, trying
yeah.
to see like what protection value does being stuck in a clump of shed bison hair offer for that seed.
That's really interesting.
And obviously, like the middle of the wallow, where they're using it a lot, rolling back and forth, mm-hmm. that stays bare dirt.
Right, yeah.
Unless they abandon it. But the edge of the wallow that gets less use, you start to see seeds grow up that normally wouldn't get a chance to grow in an established prairie because they'd be outcompeted.
Isn't there like some bison flower? Is that where? Mm-hmm. But there's one that, there's a flower, I thought it was named after bison, that's like basically no producer can make it because you have to mimic
okay.
a bison like rolling on the ground.
Yeah, I remember hearing something about this. Maybe it was might have been Bob Jackson that was telling us about that flower. Okay.
Oh, maybe. Laura Walter or Tabitha or someone, if you're listening to this, please email me.
Yeah. <the answer. laughs> But, okay, so let's go back to your test here with your quilt of many hides.
Yeah.
So you said, so red fox, that's kind of surprising. You know, we always think of like the big charismatic megafauna that are doing all the work here, but you got like foxes, you got coyotes. Yeah,
coyotes, groundhogs, badgers.
Okay, so prairie wolf and coyote. I've heard people say, no, that was a separate wolf species.
No,
but I've also heard like that's what Lewis and Clark called coyotes.
Yeah, there was so many common names being, you know, thrown, mixed and matched and back and forth that I'm pretty sure when they said prairie wolf they meant coyote.
Yeah
you know, there were different subspecies of wolves. You know, they talk about the Great Plains wolves and the ones that actively hunted bison and were a little bit bigger than say the, you know, the northeastern wolf up in Michigan or something like that.
Timber wolves or whatever.
And then these days, you know, that's all like 1800s, just anecdotal journal writing and stuff. But now the geneticists are saying, we have two species, not subspecies, two species. Well, I guess three if you count Mexican gray wolves, three species of wolves in North America. But you got Mexican gray wolves down the southwest. You've got our native wolves in like the Great Lakes region, which would be like native North America. And then you've got Eurasian wolves came over the land bridge from Siberia. Yeah. And that's what we find in the northern Rockies, and like the Yellowstone.
The red wolves down in
and then,
Carolinas.
That's another whole like salad bowl mix. Yeah. I mean, you look at the genetics of a coyote, a red wolf, eastern gray wolf, they're all interconnected. They all have some amount of genetic material from those other species mixed in, some more than others, you know.
Yep.
I thought the red wolf, isn't that like top 10 most endangered?
Oh, yeah.
There's like 100 or so left. Yeah. They're in zoos.
Functionally extinct, I think.
They've tried to release them. I think it's Great Smoky Mountain National Park or somewhere near there in North Carolina after the breeding program had been fairly successful. They put some back in the wild. But again, the biggest problem there, although they've got some trouble with poachers, you know, shooting them, but the biggest problem is interbreeding with coyotes. Because they're friends, and there's not many other red wolves to talk to.
Yeah,
just hybridize them out of existence.
Kind of like it all goes back to the remnant prairie thing we were talking about earlier.
Hybridize them out of existence. That's interesting, because you could literally hybridize Iowa ecotype species out of existence.
Yeah. Okay, so then what about, let's go back to the charismatic megafauna then. So I'm sure badgers, skunks, all of them played a role.
Yep.
How significant did you find the deer and elk role in propagating
seed dispersal?
Yeah.
Not that much. I mean, they carried some seeds, but not to the extent of bison.
What kind of seeds were you guys finding consistently with them?
With the deer and the elk?
Mm-hmm.
Most of your Velcro type seeds.
Okay.
I mean, you would get, you know, big blue stem, Indian grass. I mean, it doesn't look like something that would stick to our genes when you're walking through the prairie, but they've got enough little awns and hairs that, you know, you get thick fur, it's gonna stick to there.
Yeah.
So you find that it's just the smooth round stuff like sedges and prairie bush clover that wouldn't stick to elk and deer hide because it's shorter and it's slicker and things
prairie
like
bush
that.
Lespedeza capitata,
capitata.
Okay. Round-headed,
yeah, round-headed okay. bush cover, prairie bush, whatever you like to call it.
Interesting. Well, I was like, I don't think I've heard that before.
I think I have heard that name for it before.
Does I'm very curious because you might know the answer to this question that no one's been able to give me an answer to. We get a lot of calls because I'm pretty sure we're the only website out there that talks about having a native pasture. And so people Google it. I'm like, I have a pasture that's more native than Brome.
Huh.
So they find us and they say, what can you tell me? And I tell them, nothing. What can you tell me? I know that like cattle like big blue stem. I know that they'll chew on switchgrass. I know that that legumes is good for them to an extent. You know, your bush clover and your Illinois bundle flower and stuff like that. If I was designing like a native mix for a species to browse on, do you have any idea?
They love everything. I mean, just look at the Flint Hills in Kansas or go to the Dakotas. They graze native pastures all the time. They're prairie remnants. They call them native pasture out
Nebraska,
there.
Nebraska,
same thing. So big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass. I mean, they love all that.
And what about Forbes?
What was it? A buddy of mine, he calls it the ice cream plant, cup plant, one of the silphiums.
Yes. Okay.
He said if he puts cattle out on, he's got a lot of like remnant pasture basically, or mixes of remnants in his cool season pasture. He said the cattle go straight for that cup plant and just nail it all.
Oh, dude, this is so good. See, no one's been able to give me an answer. I've only, I maybe asked
three times on the podcast. But
yeah, a lot of people mix warm season stuff with their cool season pasture to get more length out of the grazing season.
I want to do that, but I don't want to do it in a way where Brome would totally take over because it not because Brome can kick Big Blue Stem's butt, but because it establishes so much faster. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? How would you do that? What rate, I guess, would you sell it at and recommend people to do to get it going?
Yeah, I mean, this is just shooting off the hip, but you know, I would say probably like 75% warm season and 25% cool season might give you more of a competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. And obviously different weather and precipitation different times of the year. Right now, the cool season is going to have an advantage. It's going to be growing. And then the warm season takes off. It's green in the summer, but then you get that other burst of green in October with your cool season stuff.
Yeah, I also think that paddock grazing it can really help with this too. And so now instead of – so a lot of times people are looking at, I have a pasture. You know, it will say it's a 25-acre pasture, and I just cut the cows loose in, you know, mid-spring and bring them back into the feedlots in the fall. And that is how a lot of grazing is done. I would say probably the majority of grazing that I've seen is done that way. And so then, yeah, it makes sense to have a matrix, you know, a true mix of everything just kind of thrown out on the landscape together. But if somebody is willing to divide their property up into some paddocks that make sense, and you could rotationally graze throughout the you know, growing seasons of these different grasses. It definitely takes effort with moving cows around, and definitely some significant expense with fencing and so forth. But I mean, you can use hot wires too and do some, you know, cut some costs that way. But if you wanted to, you know, you could do it a couple different ways. Like if you look at your pasture, let's say you interseeded your whole pasture with both warm and cool season grasses, and you saw, wow, there's really a stronghold of Big Blue Stem over in this part over here. Well, then I'd fence that part off. And when it gets to July, when all the brome is dead and dormant and the cows aren't really interested in it as much, move them into that paddock where those warm season grasses are nice and lush and green. And, if you got another area where it's like, man, this is almost all brome over here. Well, now you know where your early spring, or, you know, your first paddock you're going to use and probably your last paddock you're going to use for the year. So I think, you know, so much of farming is just like, well, what's the standard method for doing this? Sometimes it just needs to be, well, what makes sense?
Yeah, you can reinvent stuff. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, if you wanted to intentionally seed down different areas, different paddocks, you could have a warm season, one cool season.
Right.
And just move them around, like I said, different times of the year.
Right, right. And like I said, it's going to take a lot of effort moving cows and expense with the fencing, but it'll be worth it. It'll pay off.
Yeah. On our place, we've got old dairy pasture, and it was probably seeded to cool season grass, you know, 100+ years ago, but it's got a lot of remnant stuff in it that just kind of hangs on. And like our neighbor, he'll come over and take bales of hay off of it sometime. And if he goes to baling early, like in late May, then that's always a boost to the natives that are there. If you take off that cool season stuff early in the late spring, early summer, then the greasy grass and the switchgrass and the little blue and the broom's edge blue stem, it's all, you know, really high by August.
Yeah.
And it looks like a prairie at that point because the cool season's really short.
Yeah. Man, let's go back to greasy grass in a minute. That's something near and dear to my heart. But another thing I thought of while you were saying that is, paddock grazing is just good anyways, or rotational grazing is just good anyways, because if you're allowing cattle to be hammering those natives just as they're greening up, you know, that's going to affect the diversity and create the problem that Nicholas is concerned about with, well, eventually is brome just going to take over? And I think that would be another good reason to section off grazing areas so you give those warm seasons a chance to grow up tall and become strong plants and establish a good root system so that they come back year after year and they don't get pulled up by the seedling, you know.
Yeah, so much of what we have now is an ecosystem altered by non-native species. Mm-hmm. You know, there are big players in the game now, whereas, you know, you went back 300 years ago, the things like bison, things like elk that were hammering on those native grasses were actually giving a competitive advantage to your forbs. And so you had more diversity in a prairie with grazing. But now when you have reed canary grass and smooth brome, they they will jump right in there if you knock down the natives.
Yep, definitely. Okay, you mentioned greasy grass. We don't talk about greasy grass enough on here. And really, this can go back to what Nicholas was talking about, Canada wild rye. A problem with reconstruction is we get preferences, right? And seed mixes have to be cost effective if people are going to use them. And if the, you know, if the government is going to have to raise our taxes to obscene levels to, you know, cost share on these reestablishments for like CRP and so forth. So there's cost, there's beauty. That's a thing. That's a recent topic in the biology world. What about the ugly species? You know,
sure.
Because sometimes the ugly species are hurting, but nobody cares about them because they're not a cute little dolphin, you know?
Yep.
And so there are ugly prairie species, and there are prairie species that get associated with a problem. That would be greasy grass, right? Where people, its other name is purple top.
Yep.
And I remember when I first came across some purple top is when I was doing some weeding in one of our best Indian grass patches. And I came across this thing. I was like, is this switchgrass? And I asked Carol about it. And he's like, no, that's a purple top. And I was like, purple top? I've never even heard of purple top. And he's like, yeah, you know, there's not really much of a market for it because people, I think it's not said as much now, but people used to know purple top is like Canadian thistle or bull thistle or milk thistle, one of those. There was a nickname for it was purple top. Purple top thistle or something like that.
Sure.
And so people would see that on a seed tag and be like, you gave me purple top, you know? And so there's, it's now, you never see it now in any kind of CRP mixes. You see, of course, you know, the big five and, you know, prairie June grass, SOG and, you know, other common grasses, but you don't see greasy grass. And then the other thing, with Canada wild rye is what, Nicholas, what's the big hang up there? With Canada wild rye, why people don't want it in there? I'm just trying to keep Nicholas awake here. He's on his.
I honestly, I was thinking about, can we grow greasy grass? Do we have a place to like? I was like going through that in my brain. Well, it's because it gets in the pant legs of anybody who's walking through. Terribly, terribly itchy. Kent complains every year when he's walking through it. He's reaching up in his underwear trying to like itch out.
No, that's SOG.
Dude, it's so bad. Ben, who he's been on the podcast. So Ben, who's done a lot of work on our farm, someone said like, well, what's the SOG field? He's like, oh, are your socks filled with seed just walking in three steps?
Yeah.
And then he found the SOG field. No, the Canada wild rye, people hate it for their dogs.
Pheasant hunters.
It's like they're like little needles that can get in the corners of their dog's eyes, which it's not like,
and up their nose too, right?
Yes thank you. And it's not that hurts the dog, but that can get infected.
Sure.
So it's an irritant to the dog, and then it gets infected, and then
so Nicholas gets people who will, and I've taken calls like this too, where somebody will be like, hey, I want your whatever mix, but please take out the Canada wild rye.
Or what, it's really sad, take out that Virginia wild. Well, Virginia is a totally different shape. Yeah. Seed, you know, it's not going to be, I don't care, I don't want any of that wild rye. And
right.
Sometimes I think like,
another one that happens with are the tincture foils, Showy and Illinois tincture foil, because people hate how it sticks to their dog, hate how it sticks to their clothes.
I don't blame them one bit.
but so what happens is like we have this filtering on all these reconstructions. Does that, do you perceive, because I mean, let's be honest, the vast majority of prairie acres in Iowa is CRP.
Yeah.
You know, and so CRP is devoid of these species a lot of times.
Yeah.
Are we
self-selecting?
Are we eventually creating a real hurt on the overall population by artificially selecting these species for
potentially
for, I mean, is that a concern for like greasy grass?
It could be. I mean, I see greasy grass in a lot of like old pastures, but like you said, I don't see it in a lot of reconstructions. So yeah, we could be, you know, maybe not even consciously selecting against that for sure. I mean, we do it in forestry too. I mean, how many honey locusts get taken out, you know, because of those big thorns? Like humans have a natural avoidance of that. Like, oh yeah, let's save that maple, kill that honey locust. I mean, didn't Leopold talk about how when he was planting pines, he would, you know, if there is a red maple and a pine, he would kill the maple because he preferred pines. And then he philosophized like, well, why is that? You know, well, maybe it's because I'm, you know, in a part of the Wisconsin where pines are kind of rare and there's lots of maples. If I lived farther north where there was more pines, maybe I'd favor the maple. So I think we have our biases we sort of built into that. I know with the bisons, you know, so many of them are like raised like domestic cattle on ranches now. And there was a big concern, I think it was back in the 90s it got raised, where, you know, a lot of people that were raising them as livestock for like production or meat or whatever, they were selecting traits just like you would with cow. Like they liked darker color calves or black fur instead of brown fur or big hindquarters for steaks. And there was concern, like, what are we doing to bison as a species if
that's
we're selecting this group of them for different traits? So
that's, man, I didn't hear about, I did hear about the whole beefalo thing, like how every, what is it, every bison, even all the wild bison pretty much. And I just imagine like up in Alaska where there, it's a remote population.
Well, but even those got moved to Alaska. They've been reintroduced. So yeah, I actually met the guy that did that. They loaded him up on big army cargo planes. They dumped him off, you know, middle of Alaska, and then they couldn't find him for like 6 or 7 years. And then finally they showed up, you know, 50 miles away or something like that.
That's crazy.
But yeah, I think it was Jim Durr out of Texas A&M did the initial genetic work on bison, and this is back like in 2010 or so, and he was saying like almost every herd has cattle gene intergression.
That's crazy.
I think they identified like 6 herds in North America at that time that didn't have cattle genes mixed in with them.
That's crazy.
So Yellowstone was one, Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota was another one. There's a few places in Canada, but most every other place, I mean, because you think about it, you know, early 1900s, a lot of these ranchers were just gathering up, you know, the orphan calves that were out there, and they'd bring them back as a novelty or whatever.
There was one of the last ones in Iowa was just down the road, down 92 here in Sigourney. That was in Dr. Dinsmore's book. It was like you said, somebody brought like a calf back or something like that.
And yeah, sometimes there was intentional crossbreeding programs, like you said, trying to create beefalo breed. And then sometimes they're just accidents, you know, fences go down and things happen. Now you got a half buffalo, half cattle. And then those were bred back in with bison. And then over time, those genes got diluted and you can't really tell. If you look at it, like, it looks like a bison. Can't see any cattle genes, but when you do the DNA testing, you realize, there's genes that shouldn't be in a bison. And I don't think we've really figured out, like, what does that do to them? Does that reduce their fitness? Are they not able to handle cold winters or something with the breeding or disease resistance? We don't know. The only thing I've ever seen worked on it, they said that bison that had more cattle genes than others were smaller in size. But that could be for a lot of reasons. You know, put them on an island, they get smaller in size after a few generations. But we're really not sure at this point what it's doing to them as a species. But I know the agencies that work with conservation herds, like at Neil Smith and at the National Bison Range in Montana and Oklahoma, they work pretty hard to keep those genetics not only away from cattle, but keep those genetics diverse and mixed up between different herds so you don't have all your eggs in one basket, literally.
Man.
I know back when I was doing research at Neil Smith, one of the ways we would collect hair was when they do their handling like event every fall. They'd bring all the bison through the corrals and the squeeze chute. And you'd have a bison container. Like, I could cut hair off of them. That was part of my project. But then we're also taking blood samples and pulling tail hair for genetics on all the first-year calves that were coming through. And they'd all get a microchip, you know, so they could identify them, like put it in their neck. And then the next year when they came through, they'd be in the chute and you just wave the wand over it. And then that spits out to a laptop, which is like literally 5 feet away. And it would say, oh yeah, this is a calf number, blah, blah, blah. And it was a female and this is what it weighed last year. And in that course of the year, they had done all the genetic workup on that bison. And so they could say, this one has very common genes. Let's ship this off to another facility because, you know, they could only keep so many bison in that area. Once they got too numerous, they had to send some out to other places. Or they might say, oh, this one has really rare alleles. Let's keep it here in this herd so we can conserve these genetic traits. And so they, just like zoos with breeding programs, you know, they work with all these different agencies across the country to maintain that genetic diversity.
How big?
It's pretty slick.
How big of a difference is the genetic diversity make in their form or function?
That we don't really know.
Okay.
Bison as a whole are pretty not diverse genetically. Mm. And for a long time we thought, well, you know, late 1800s, they went through a huge bottleneck. You went from 30 million down to like, what, 600 or something? And they said, okay, well, you know, this is when we lost a lot of genes. And then as genetic techniques got better and technology advanced, they started doing more work with them. And they said, no, it actually wasn't 1800s. It was the last ice age when they lost genetic diversity. That was another huge bottleneck. They almost went extinct at the end of the last ice age, but they pulled out of it at the last minute.
That's interesting, because every other megafauna, basically, besides some quick-running deer and elk and things, basically everything else went extinct.
Yeah.
You know, and then the bison almost did.
Yeah, I think bison are the only North American mammal over 2,000 pounds that made it through the ice age. Man. Everything that was bigger than that went extinct.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Even including bigger species of bison, like bison antiquus.
Yeah, and like our modern bison are like direct descendants from bison antiquus.
Okay. They're
basically same form, just smaller. You know, 6 foot at the shoulder instead of seven, that kind of stuff. 2,000 pounds for a bull instead of 3,000. Yeah.
So is it technically a subspecies then? Our modern?
I think it's been differentiated enough now, a long enough time. You would call it a species,
a whole separate species.
But
okay,
I'd have to check with the geneticists on that one.
Yeah,
I mean, it has a different species name. The scientific name's different.
So. Right. Okay, so we're over the hour mark here, and we probably need to start trending this one down. But I got another big question for you here, Pete. As we look towards, you know, an eventual goal of recovering much of our lost grassland, we understand too. Again, a shout out to Pete Berthelsen. I think he does a good job explaining this. It has to make sense. Like, if we're going to have this many people, we got to have agriculture, large scale agriculture. It'd be great if it was all a bunch of small farmers collectively making a large-scale model of agriculture. But nonetheless, we got to have a lot of agrable acres. But there's certainly way too many acres that are farmed that should have never been farmed. And if we could recover those, do we ever get these important grazers back on the landscape, and even in some cases, important predators, you know, mountain lions, black bears.
Maybe. I mean, it would take a huge cultural shift.
Yeah.
Cultural shift. But if we wanted to go to that direction, I think it's definitely possible.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. What has to happen? Do you think in our lifetimes, let's start somewhere kind of small, and something that we've seen a lot of other states doing. Let's just go with elk.
Yep.
All of our neighbors have a wild elk population.
Yeah,
even if it's small, other than maybe Illinois. I don't know if Illinois does yet.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But Nebraska, South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, they're all doing it. In our lifetimes, what has to happen now in Iowa for that to be possible, and will it happen?
Well, habitat shift, number one. I mean, you got a lot of acres of bare ground. I was just up in an airplane the other day, and I was looking down, and, you know, this is early spring, and there's a lot of bare dirt right now. It's just kind of mind-boggling when you think about wind erosion, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. And you don't see that on the ground as much. We just kind of get used to that.
Right.
But from a habitat standpoint, if you're looking for browse, if you're an elk, you know, obviously you're bigger than a deer, and you're moving herds and things like that. I'm sure they could survive in some areas where you had habitat corridors and, you know, river bottoms and things like that. But over the majority of the landscape, there would have to be some large scale habitat changes, putting more prairie grass on, things like that. And then the other big thing is, you know, just cultural acceptance. Are people willing to have an elk herd get in their cornfield? Are they willing to whack one with their car at night? You know, obviously other states live with them, you know, and I was telling my students the other day, they were talking about, you know, bears moving back into Iowa. And I said, well, you know, Missouri has bears, Arkansas has bears, Montana has bears, and people live with those. You know, here in Iowa, you hear about a bear, it's like, oh my gosh, call the cops, lock up the children.
Right.
You know, and like, if a bear gets into your garbage cans in Minnesota, that's a Tuesday.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah.
Like, okay, well, yeah. Normal. I'll secure it better next time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the cultural dynamics would have to change, I think, for Iowa to have large herbivores like elk or even bison or things like mm-hmm. that.
What do you think would be a big step in that direction that's practical and feasible?
Well, I think you would have to start with some kind of like a either a CRP type program where you know, putting like wildlife habitat on the ground, and then the other thing, maybe if you could link it with some kind of economic benefit.
Yeah,
I remember years ago I was reading this old book, and it was written by like this cowboy from the like 1800s. It wasn't an ecology book or science book or anything.
Bob Fudge? Is that
No, I can't even remember the name of it. It was just like a journal, like memoirs of this cowboy, and he was, you know, he was lamenting how things had changed. And he was writing this like in the 20s or the 30s. And he was talking about in the old days when he was a young cowboy, you had grass-fed steers, and you would raise them till they were like 5 years old. And that's when you would send them to market, you know, because that's when they had reached that point where they had enough marbling in their beef to, you know, make it where people wanted to eat it. And he was saying, well, since World War I, we had all this surplus corn, and we said, hey, let's feed it to livestock. And we figured out that we could take an 18-month-old steer, and if you feed them corn, which is like the equivalent of giving chips and candy to a teenager, and let them sit around in a feedlot, you know, kind of like on the couch playing video games, they will get as much fat on a teenage cow as a like a middle-aged cow would on grass.
Wow.
And he said, you know, the beef doesn't taste the same or something like that. You know, he's kind of complaining about this in the 20s and 30s. And I thought, well, what if we applied that now? What if we took, you know, all these acres that are growing corn and being fed to livestock, a lot of it to feedlot cattle. Mm-hmm. What if we converted that to pasture and then raise
livestock,
raid the, you know, cows want to eat grass, right? Yeah. That's what their stomachs are designed to eat. Right.
Right.
They're not grain eaters. And so what if you raise those to 4 or 5 years old before you sold them, you could have a lot more acres of grass. Which, you know, that's not a prairie, even if it's cool season, but it's still a lot more wildlife habitat.
Even the fossil fuels you're not using on those acres, but still getting a lot of food out of it.
Exactly.
Well, so
you would need some kind of bridge, though, for the farmers to make a profit. Because you can't just sit and make no profit for 4 or 5 years. Right.
Look, man, I feel like...
this is what Ted Cook talks about.
Yeah. He says we need to pay the
landowner for the resource we want.
Well, so... In that cultural, there would definitely be a shift, and it would be a hard economic shift that would need to flow. And here's why. Because right now, land is so expensive because of its guaranteed return for cash crops.
Yeah.
So, but I think if we did a lot more of that, land would come down in price because in order to get that return, there has to be more hard work put into it. I'm not saying that the farmers need to wait 4 or 5 years, but we're pretty good at coming up with economic strategies to get what we want. So if it took selling futures, like farmers having to sell futures and stuff like that, but I think that I think that's a brilliant idea. My I guess a data calculus question would be, how much food per acre are we producing? Now we're creating a lot better food if we've got cows on grass instead of cows on corn, but like 1 acre of corn, how much feed is that? Like how many bowls can you bring to market?
Sure.
How many
pounds of beef do you get on a grass versus corn
per acre? Exactly.
And somebody needs to crunch the numbers on that,
because I feel like those, as long as you have the data, those aren't hard numbers to crunch. You know, that's basic algebra.
Sure.
And I think that that would be a very interesting path forward. I've never heard anybody talk about that. I've heard about people talking about grazing on CRP and stuff like that, but to specifically replace grain-fed cattle and have opportunity to have more.
Yeah, but if you took even half the acres that are in crop production now and put that back into pasture, think of the soil erosion control, water quality improvement, wildlife habitat.
8 million or something. That'd be 9 million acres of habitat.
That'd be huge.
Yeah. It, just in Iowa, not including other states.
When I teach botany class here, one of the like field labs that we do is we have a lot of rural area right around campus, and we'll go out and do vegetation surveys. And, you know, there's a plowed cornfield over here, and we'll drop down a square, a transect, and you know, maybe you find two or three species. Well, there's corn, right? And then maybe a foxtail, or maybe a velvet leaf or something like that. And then we'll go over to
three non-native species. Right?
We'll go over to a cattle pasture next door, and we might find 10 species. You know, there's smooth brom and Kentucky bluegrass and a bunch of other stuff. And then we'll go to the prairie remnant that's right here on the north side of campus. You'll have 37 species in the same square, you know, and they can see that, you know, within an hour's time, like, whoa, this is different.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess then teaching why more species is a bigger deal, and not, so you're not just talking about genetic diversity of each plant, but diversity of soil and resources. So I've got a question for that. In terms of teaching your students, what are you seeing in students when they're coming in and when they're leaving? Are you feeling hopeful? Are you nervous about it?
Oh, yeah. I'd say, especially when you go from that freshman transfer to the senior over 4 years, you see a shift in their knowledge base and what they know. And sometimes I'm amazed at how much they know that, you know, things I didn't when I was that age.
Yeah.
You know, I think with internet and so much more information available, they've got a lot of stuff that they can pick up that, you know, if we didn't have an old guy to ask the questions, you just didn't know that. That wasn't part of your universe.
Do you think in 20 years, when people my age are kind of owning the land and stuff like that, do you think there will be more habitat or less?
I'd like to say more. I like to be a glasses half full.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, I guess that speaks well to your job. You're like, I feel like I'm doing a pretty good job.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when students come in and you see that transformation, not necessarily just on conservation, what are you seeing students is like thought process, or I think the technical term is schema on agriculture in Iowa?
Oh, it depends. You mean, so many of the students we get here come from all over the country, all over the world. A lot of them are highly urbanized places, and they have no clue coming in. You know, like walking in a cornfield is a big adventure for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen it here at Penn. I've seen it at Iowa State. So, you know, it just depends on their background. But, you know, you'll get students from a farm background where, you know, maybe they're like, well, we do it this way because dad always does it, or grandpa always did it this way. But as they learn some of the ecology, like, well, you know, I like turkey hunting, I like pheasant hunting. Maybe if I did it this other way, I could have farming and these other, you know, wildlife benefits too. Yeah. So you start to see some of those lights go on.
Do they fight you at first at all?
No, I generally don't get, I mean, occasionally. I remember distinctly getting into a fairly heated discussion about prairie dogs with a student from, I think she was from Wyoming. We were talking about benefits of prairie dogs and, you know, like as a keystone species and all these things they do with bison and antelope. And she was dead set that prairie dogs were evil and they should all be killed. And, and so the other students in the class actually kind of got into a heated discussion with her, you know, so that was interesting one day.
Wow. Yeah, that is interesting because, I mean, think of like how it probably has affected her and her dad and her mom and her
but if that's the world you grow up in, like this is what I know, and people that are older and wiser than me have told me this is the way.
Yeah,
and that's the way I think.
Yeah, you know? And usually there's probably a lot of blood and sweat and tears behind that worldview of like this thing, to have that strong of an emotional response. Sure. You know,
and there's probably some real, you know, economic driver behind that, like, oh, the prairie dogs are eating grass that our cattle should be eating, they're not gaining enough weight or whatever. Mm-hmm. That, you know, somebody from Chicago doesn't even think about that. They just like prairie dogs.
Right. Yeah. You know? Yeah, dude, that is fascinating. So I guess wrapping up the thing about the students, when if you could teach every single student one thing, like guaranteed they would learn this thing from when you have them to when they leave, what would you make sure each one of them knew?
Wow. I guess I would want them to know their place in the world, to be able to, you know, have some kind of grounded connection to the place they live.
Oh, like geographically.
Yeah. That you not just
to know their place.
Not just look, well, not like be able to find it on a map, but, you know who their ecological neighbors are. Be able to walk out and like, I know the plants here. I know the animals that live here. I know what insects are coming out this time of year. Because I think, especially with smartphones and internet access everywhere, so many young people are getting disconnected from what's right in front of them. Mm. Yeah. You know, they're connected to someplace thousands of miles away and people they've never seen in person, but they can't tell you what tree's in their backyard. They can't tell you what bird that is on the fence. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think one of the things I try to do with every class is get them outside and touching real things and experiencing real things rather than watching videos or looking in a book. Mm-hmm. So they have that connection to what's right here. Yeah. And then take what they learned here in Iowa and go back to wherever they're from and apply that.
I can help you with that. If you've got like a summer class, they can hoe weeds. They learn stuff real quick.
This weed and that weed.
Yeah.
You bet.
Oh, man. Ken, did you have anything else before?
No, this was excellent. This was as good as I'd hoped. It was nice that we went from saltwater crocodiles to prairie dogs and everything in between and just hearing the, you know, getting a deeper understanding. And maybe we'd love to have you back on the show at some point. Maybe we can do a deeper dive into your research on, and we didn't tell Pete to have that ready to go, but I think if we let you have a couple of weeks to study back up on some of the stuff you guys did, it'd be really fascinating because that is it's an area where you're starting to hear more about it, you know. Burning is probably the biggest new topic now, you know, new quote unquote, right? People have been known about, but I mean, like you go to a conference and that's the hot item. That's going to be, you know, the breakout sessions. Everyone's going to go to a burning session at least once, you know, and then invasive species was probably the big thing before that, invasive removal. But I really think that kind of becoming the new thing is, okay, well, let's look at how important these grazers were and how do we get them back on this current, you know, landscape model that we have right now. And I think it is going to, you know, be hopefully the next piece of the puzzle that we try to work in more frequently with these restored and reconstructed prairies. I think that you have a lot to offer there through that, but thanks so much for being willing to sit down with us, and we ate up some of your prep time for grading papers and putting together lessons and everything else. But we really appreciate you. And
yeah, glad to be here. It's fun.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's nice that you're a local guy. And if you're listening in, do know that you can still plant some prairie this time of year. You might have to do a little cold stratification in the refrigerator to get a good forb establishment in your prairie. But you can still order seed from HoxieNativeSeeds.com or ThePrairieFarm.com. And Nicholas will gladly talk you through on the phone with whatever you need for that. And
Ken's smiling because he knows how many hours every day, just the sheer number of send phone him an calls email. I get. Yeah. I mean, just, whew.
But he likes it. Nick's a people person.
That's what I'm here for.
And he will give you the full time you need to get what you need going on the ground. And that matters a lot to us. And so definitely check out those things. Be watching our social media accounts and follow them if you haven't. I think some things are shifting around on our Hoxie Instagram account eventually and our Facebook account. But also, the Prairie Farm, account on Instagram is much more active now. Be sure you're following along with that. You can see all sorts of behind the scenes stuff. Our good friend Joy is helping us with those things. So, just like we learned today, we have a true, lifetime dedicated person to not just prairies, but wild places. And, he works every day to help change minds. He knows well that conservation happens one mind at a time.